I'm really impressed with the New Testament lay ministry version. And anybody thinking restorationist is going to think that way. And I think I won't speak for everybody, but I do have a desire for that kind of world. But here, so there's a question for comment. It feels like also an eschatological, a expecting the second coming in our lifetime kind of structure and restoration. And I have the sense that that's the way people thought in 1830, but that pretty soon after we get structure, organization, more Old Testament, which has the feeling of we're in this for the long term. We are, this is, we're structuring for centuries rather than for our lifetime. Throw that out for your reaction.
So, you mean you're kind of expressing maybe David Whitmer's feeling that he prefers the lay Christian ministry to going back and bringing in the Old Testament as well, or are you?
I guess I'm suggesting that is my inclination as well. That yes, that David Whitmer, but I'm also suggesting that that it is most appropriate when you are thinking we are already in the end times, and that as an organization moves forward and starts grappling with we're in this for a longer period, then you get, 1831, 1834, 1836 kind of structure, and that it doesn't have just three people ordained, but more and more.
I think that there's a real trend. I think there's a natural trend in the church. People are so hungry for an earlier lay Christian, New Testament, and mystic Christianity in Mormon religion and culture, and people are they're reaching out to that, like with Jana going to the Living School and working with Richard Rohr, and people and Jody reaches out to a number of other forums as well, and I did. I went to Gnostic Christianity for, gosh, 15 years, and then came back because I didn't realize it was there. I didn't realize how much was actually there. And I'm hoping that we're bringing it back because we've been so focused on the hierarchical authority that evolves with the priesthood orders, and then with the temple as the place of priesthood, we have forgotten the power of our original lay Christian ministry, which was the church for the first year and a half, and how charismatic it was, and why Hiram Page is receiving revelations, and Oliver thinks he's a prophet, and they're good ones, and Joseph is like, wait a second, okay. Yeah, we can all have seer stones. We're all seers and visionaries, but there's still one who talks face to face with God. And so there's always been this tension, I think, in the LDS tradition from the beginning of how do we manage that? How do we really live as disciples with that equality where there is no black and white, no slave and free, no male and female. We are all one in Christ, How do we balance that with this hierarchy that evolved when the hierarchy tended to overwhelm sort of the lay Christian ministry of the democratic workings of the spirit. And I think that's a tension that's always there. And so we have to sort of focus on the ward as the place where we get to practice that every member a minister. We're all ordained ministers with our confirmation, a minister of Christ. And I've really kind of talked about that a lot since I came back to the church about really delving into what that means and practicing. And as Jody said beautifully, doing it, moving into it, bringing it back and just living it and being a true lay minister of Christ. I think it's an individual, like Jody expressed beautifully, it's an individual practice. It's a spiritual practice to be a lay minister. But I would love to see us recover more of that sense. I've really talked about it a lot since coming back to the church. It's what I'm really attuned to, is that Christian lay ministry that we began as our first sort of stage of the restoration.
So I was really struck and appreciated the kind of disconnecting out the legal roles from the ecclesiastical, this lay ministry, and that kind of helped me to connect some dots and kind of envision what happened, what went wrong, right? How we came to lose that
And misread it. We've been
and misread
misreading
it,
it.
that kind of legal overlay as the church is getting organized in this patriarchal society that has these kind of preset rules and structures, and the church is having to work within that, then gets boxed in by it, right, over time. And adopts, comes to invest so much in that legal structure and miss the spiritual truth and like what ministry and really looks like.
And really
That was really striking to me. And it made me think again too about, over time again, how much was lost with the universal message of Joseph Smith and this really kind of mystical understanding of the deep connections between the human among the human family, and that it's not just about these, particular lineages or your own family, that it really is this, we are all God's children. We will all need to be one for the earth to fulfill its purpose.
Yeah, I'm really glad you keyed on that because it's really important. We've been misreading it, going looking backward, particularly through a patriarchal and a hierarchical lens, because Joseph Smith is really doing this radical shattering equality in the ecclesiastical structure that isn't being done at that time. And so in the secular legal side of the church, he's setting it up to meet those standards of that time. And it's men with legal authority to preach and to have a church. But within the ecclesiastical structure, from the get-go, from him and Emma going together to the hill to get the plates and working together to translate them. And then as the first three off top officers of the church in 1830, he's seeing women as equal and parallel, and they're gendered offices, but they're perfectly parallel. And so
No,
it is, it's very progressive.
I would argue that we're not misreading in this way. What struck me when you were talking about that period and coverture, which I've been writing about and working on myself, is that the 19th Amendment is not until 1920. I mean, Joseph Smith is really radical for his time. And if he's going to get any more men than Oliver, than just a handful of people involved or engaged, he's going to have to deal with men who are expect to be in charge, expect to have the power. And that's 1830, that's 1835. I mean, in a sense, the reality of the situation is that unless he's going to be limited to a very small handful of men and women, he's in order to move forward as a church, he's going to involve men who expect to be in charge, and that's the only way he could do it.
Exactly. And we really
Maybe, I
see.
don't know. So I'm gonna, maybe, but I think, I mean, I think the way it comes out here in 1830, right, is that there's like both going on. And how is he going to get the saints to this kind of other place? And there is, I mean, there's a lot of experimentation. Like, in order to build a church, you have to get women, right? It's women who are the primary churchgoers and can bring their families in.
They're
And
central.
I mean, women are key to the Second Great Awakening. And so. And there's a lot of, kind of experimentation going on with, different types of shared authority and parallel, tracks. So, kind of that truth is in the air, maybe.
Well, I think it's interesting to talk about the context of the time, which, I mean, context determines everything. But at the same time, we're still dealing with this. In our time, it's appalling the conversations and the actions that are being taken right now in the church and the government and civilization to completely eliminate anything except those that are perceived as the correct leaders. So we're still dealing with this, and we're still dealing with how is it that you build or maintain or grow an organization, acknowledging that that the wealthy people or the capable people or the powerful people or the charismatic people are going to want to be in charge. And I think we're still dealing with that same problem with here we've got a shadow quorum that's basically a law firm. And that has been strengthened in many ways that aren't official when it could have been an opportunity to have an equal quorum, at least of women. And the difference that could make in the building of an organization. But it would take a vision, it would take creativity, it would take an expansive view instead of trying to play it safe. And so, in the context of what Chris brought up about at the time, Joseph's got to be wrestling with this. Is it ever going to be more than a few people gathered in a cabin? Well, then we have to deal with this tension and this wrestling. And at what point do we have the courage to break through and do something that is completely not following the established power system, but with the possibility that could be so much more inspiring and expansive over the long term without, worrying about, okay, what does it do to the quarterly report and the stockholders? Instead of looking at, okay, well, how are we going to do the quarterly report and please the stockholders, going, okay, what's this going to do for a generation from now, for two generations? Because that idea that it's all going to be the end times any day now really is a scapegoat. It's a, but we don't have to deal with this. We don't have to wrestle with it because Jesus is going to come tomorrow. But as I grew up with seeing this cartoon that was in Dad's office of the guy, the bearded guy walking with the picket sign that said, "The end is not near. You must learn to cope." Well, that type of thing requires a creativity and a willingness to really see each other as essential to everybody.
Yeah, nicely said. I just think that tension has always been there. I think both Chris and Rebecca are right in that men expect to take over, they're expected to take over, but in reality, women are central, not marginal, to all these things. And like what Jody said, they're there, and it's how we negotiate this, because there is a tendency to expect, or for men often expect, and even women, to sort of be in charge or be the stronger voice or not be equally represented on in a group. And yet women are always so central to what's happening. They're always doing the work, and so we need to live that more explicitly and consciously.
I should acknowledge or admit that I have for decades now been really bothered by the 1908, can't remember whether it's 1908 or 1918, decision to enhance the role of young men, but not women or young women, by
Yeah, it's
incorporating
1908
them
priesthood coalition.
as deacons and in the whole sacrament process. And that was very explicitly for engaging men in the work, and a whole decision process that I really bothers me, but it is a decision process. It is the lens through which I see the church making pragmatic decisions about how to engage and involve men in the work. And I think we've been harmed by it, but there it is. I see it happening regularly over time.
That's a really important moment, Chris. It's 1908. It's when Joseph F. Smith institutes priesthood correlation. And J. Golden Kimball said it was because the women were outperforming the men in every sphere of church activity, and the male quorums were standing by looking awestruck. I quote that in the Introduction to Women in Authority. So it's a reaction to the fact that, as Rebecca pointed out, women are central. They're doing the work. They're going to town. The Relief Society was, had the grain saving mission and selling grain to people who needed it. And so it's this attempt, it was an attempt to activate the men because the men weren't very active. They weren't jumping in and doing what they could do. But we lost that sense of women fleshing out, naming their order and naming their offices. The Relief Society minutes clearly stipulated, Joseph Smith said, that the women would name their own organization, which they did, and their own order, and that they would name their own offices. He said, whether you want to call yourselves priests and deacons like we do, or whether you want to use other offices. Well, that all got disrupted with the martyrdom and the move west. But Eliza R. Snow, and particularly Sarah Granger Kimball, who had really invited everyone to formalize the Relief Society and get that going in 1842, they were calling quorums of young women as deacons and teachers, and forming these. They were trying to finish that process of naming the young women's offices, and they were opting for the parallel of the men in as deacons and teachers, and so they just didn't get to finish that, because by that time in the 1850s and 60s, when they were trying to give the young women those offices, the bishops were pulling the other way. They'd already lost the sense of what was trying to happen in Kirtland and Nauvoo, and they were pushing back. And so it just kind of, dissolved. And then later, the young women came up with beehives. That was first. They were all beehives, and then they were Maya Maids and Laurel. So it's really, and now that's gone. They've eliminated those. So I'm hoping we're moving back to the Relief Society and young women finally naming their offices. I hope we get back to that.
So Linda asks, would Brigham Young have promoted the leadership of women? We've got Joseph Fielding Smith. We've got now Brigham Young.
It's a
I
great
see Rebecca
question.
shaking her head, but that's
He
just
did
a setup
he
for
did
a that's a there's a softball question.
yeah he did preserve women's leadership, but he subverted it, subordinated it under male leadership. That was the shift. And also, he
Dissolves
didn't
it
want the
for a
Relief
while
Society to meet
too,
until
so that
he
it
asked.
can, so that it's kind of gone under, and so that we lose this historical
Right.
connection to what it had been.
Right.
And then
He
no
subverted
longer
it
have
at
the
all
autonomy.
three levels, the lay ministry, the Relief Society, and the temple. In 1845 and 46, that's when he did it. 1845, all of his statements. As soon as Joseph was gone, he puts the women under his authority on all three levels. Sorry, Jody, go ahead.
No, and there was a loss of autonomy. It was the beginning of it always being subjected to male permission.
Right.
Well, I'm just struck by this other aspect of that tension, right? Like it's so heavily these questions, how do we structure it? How do we get this to go past this generation? How do we do that? I think a focus on that, regardless of the structure between the men and the women, we're also losing this the focus on the structure creates this tension between the individual. The personal, the spiritual connection that individuals can have. And I think I grew up in this place where the structure just to me was, this is what it is. I'd never even thought to question how that structure, if that's what it was supposed to be, it just is what it is, and we move within that. But as I'm getting older and seeing other ways of doing things and exploring my own spirituality, I'm just noticing how a structure that I think we would all hope is just there to help us move forward and support us has become so dominant that we've squashed the magic of the personal prophetic,
Right.
the movement of that the lay Christian, structure might have had earlier on. You know, that tension also squashes out the personal, and not just for women, but for men as well.
Right.
Because unless you're in the hierarchy, you are also voiceless. So it's, I don't know, that's something that I see people wrestling with in my office over and over and over again, is how dominant the structure and the hierarchy has become, to the point that they can't even find their own way in it, their own voice, their own spirituality, their own connection in it. It's overshadowed it so completely.
It's a real tragedy.
Very directly, the loss of that. This is my voice unto all.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah, it's a great point, Rebecca. You know, in looking at other churches and other religions that I explored for years after my excommunication, I was struck by noticing that the kind of the lay Christian, the lay ministry ones, like the Quakers and Christian Scientists and Baha'i, they were amazing. Every individual was empowered, and yet they didn't have the kind of organizational, global mobilization and power that something like the LDS Church has with its structure. And so there's a real need. And then there are churches that are just highly, highly regimented, even more than ours. When I was looking at sacramental Christianity and being ordained in Gnostic churches, they were too hierarchical. There wasn't enough of the lay ministry there for me. And so I had to come back to Mormonism because it has both. It really has both. And I think it's amazing. But the hierarchical authority really has overshadowed the lay Christian ministry in a lot of ways. And I think it has to come back on the word level. I've been working on a book called Every Member a Minister to kind of flesh this out and explain this, because I agree with Jana. I mean, so many people are struggling under the weight of the hierarchical authority and the voice of the prophet. And yet I love that tension between Oliver and Joseph and Hiram Page, you know, about, wait a second. Well, okay, we're all prophets, but okay, I'm a little bit higher than the others.
Everybody's equal except those who are more equal than others.
Except that one guy.
Maxine, because I so agree, I like your focus back on the word. And just a personal story. We had one of those, a couple of years ago, we had one of those visits from the stake president in our home. He was a really good guy. We have a new stake president now, but I told him to his face, I said, you know, I really have no interest in anything beyond the word level. I'm not interested in what you have to say or what the state conference has to say. I'm living in the ward. And he took it very well. He really did. But I thought it was a pretty radical thing to say to his face anyway.
Well, and this is something that I think we're trying to reclaim, which is our own connection to inspiration, to wrestling, to revelation. And it just seems like a lot of people who come to me and are sent to me, like, you know, talk this through with someone who doesn't have an agenda. And how often when people are saying, well, I want them to tell me this, or I want them to tell me that. And I keep using the phrase, don't seek answers from those not asking your question. And in the ward level, that becomes a little clearer. You know personally the messiness of each other, and you're less likely to go, I'm not going to expect him to answer my question. He's the one who yells at my dog, you know, and you're more likely to realize that you've got a certain ownership, a certain investment in this community. And that so often there's this overshadowing of this huge, distant, separate hierarchy that people are just waiting until the right answers come from the General Conference pulpit, instead of realizing they're probably not asking my questions, but I can ask them, and I can be directed. They're concerned about, you know, the institution and keeping things running and keeping things funded and trying to retain membership. They don't have and that's their job. And to somehow separate this hierarchical authority and see that it's distinct to their job, it's distinct to their calling, but it is not the same as your own authority over you,
mm-hmm.
and your own calling to be drawn towards this godlike transformation. They can't do that for you, and we desperately want them to. So getting to the point where we're kind of giving each other permission to be distinct, recognize they have their job, and right now, that's not where my questions are. That's not where mm-hmm. my struggling is.
Yeah. That's why I think it's so important to reclaim the lay Christian ministry on the ward level. The ward is the lay Christian church, and it's even modeled on the early house church. I noticed when I came back to the church after studying early Christianity that early house church model of the bishop, the deacons, and the priests is right there in sacrament meeting. That's the early house church. And we just need to bring the women back into that lay ministry with that parallel equality so that the women sit on the stand too, and the beehives or the deaconesses pass the sacrament too, and the priestesses, you know, that we've got a priest and a priestess blessing the sacrament, and we've got a deacon and a deaconess serving it, you know, so that parallel equality comes back. But the model is there. It's right there in sacrament meeting. And every, it's a lay ministry where everyone preaches. When you stand up to give a talk or bear your testimony, you are in the role of the priest at the altar, the intercessor between God and the community. I mean, every member gets to go into to occupy the sanctuary in the position of the priest or the minister in other churches. And I love that. I love the lay ministry of sacrament meeting. That's where it's at. But I just want to see that inclusion, that parallel equality of the Christian lay ministry come back fully.
Yeah, and that's what I want to see. I want to see people be empowered to be able to bring that kind of gift to their community rather than just have it be a parroting
right.
of everything that I've learned. But how do we empower people to seek that internal power that is given them directly by God with no intercessor so that they can share those gifts?
Yeah, we are the intercessor. We ourselves, there's no one between us and God. I mean, we overlooked that, Jana, and it's amazing. It's like we have to go out and, you know, rediscover mystic early Christianity to realize that that's there and we're missing it entirely.
Absolutely. Yeah.
This brings me back to just this amazing point that you brought out, Maxine, that Emma is her own scribe for her own revelation. She gets to be the scribe for her own revelation.
Yeah.
That just really stands out to me. Stands out to me.
I'm glad you noticed that, because there's more than one revelation in the Doctrine and Covenants that's kind of related, that's caused or created because of her. There's 25 and there's 26 and 27. They're all related to her. And then 89, the word of wisdom. In fact, 27 kind of invokes, it's like this reference to what will be the word of wisdom later. They're very connected. And I see all of those as kind of provoked by Emma and her role. And it also foreshadows the final blessing before Joseph leaves. When he leaves to go to Carthage, Emma asks him for a blessing. She needs a blessing. She needs a revelation. She needs something, because they're both afraid he's going to die. And of course he does. And he tells her, you go ahead. You write down what you feel you need. Basically, you go ahead and have the revelation and I'll sign it. And he's entirely capable of giving a revelation. He's not too tired. And this is a big deal. He loves giving revelations and receive, you know, blessings, and he can do it at the drop of a hat, day or night. And this is leaving his wife, and who he's probably never going to see again. And I see that as a transferal of authority. He's basically thinking, I may not be coming back. You come into your power. You receive the revelation, and I'll sign it. It's really interesting.
I think that goes
Next,
away. You know, this is an interesting comment from Emily about, you know, your son being told by a stake leader that how proud they should be that they have more power than the Pope. And I think, you know, again, this idea that there's only a certain amount, and isn't it great we have more and someone has less because of this authority. And I think when this example of Emma, it's almost like an opportunity for her to go, I don't have to wait for someone else. I've got the authority, and the greatest authority any of us have is that kind. That kind, not the Pope, not the young men in the warden. Yes, it really bugs me because I've had deacons come up and be snotty to me because they're told stuff like this. But we have the authority. I have the authority to just go, look, you little twit. You don't have any authority that matters when you're, especially when you're behaving, you know, and we need to, like, we can do that. You know, just kind of the authority that matters is when we are godlike. And no authority is greater than that.
Authority comes from our relationship with God. We bring it forth. Catherine had two comments, questions I thought I should mention. She said, Catherine Schertz said, but Brigham Young did recognize and promote women's authority to give healing blessings. Yes, the Relief Society continued to be actually pretty self governing and doing much of what it did. The Relief Society doesn't lose its autonomy until the turn of the century. It's just that it still has autonomy. It still is doing many of the same things, but it's seen as under Brigham and the apostles. And so, and then Catherine also asked, did the women at that time in 1830 have a sense of Emma, her authority and her role? That's a really good question. The best information that we get is from Tollage and Eliza R. Snow in The Women of Mormondom, and it's a mind blower, that book. But because there's not a lot of information about that early Kirtland period, but what we do know, and I've given a couple of papers on this, is that women are coming into the church, they're joining the church, and they're bringing their, it's just what you were saying, Jody, they're bringing their spirituality with them. They're bringing their own relationship with God, their own spiritual gifts into the church with them, and they're functioning from that, which is why this Society of Sisters forms in Kirtland, and that's where the Relief Society begins, because they're literally restoring what they saw as the ancient order of female disciples and apostles in the Jesus movement. And they're working from that spiritual connection that they feel that they have with God, because this amazing church that they have found is a lay Christian ministry, unlike other churches where it's a professional ministry and everyone's spiritual gifts and revelations are welcome. So they come into the church, and these women in Kirtland are coming in with all of this spiritual power, and they're having spiritual experiences, and they're speaking in tongues and giving blessings. And so it's really interesting how they feel like they have the ability to really help create this new church and be just as much a part as the men. And it's only over time, you know, as the church is trying to find its structure, and also the sexism of the time is affecting things, that things veer away from that. But again, it's a balance between charisma and organization, you know.
I think it's interesting what happened. I think it was just this last weekend, kind of a reminder of this. Was it a broadcast with the auxiliary presidencies
Yeah,
and
that's where I quoted Camille Johnson. They
yeah, I
were
didn't.
at the Red Brick Store, the Relief Society
Yeah,
presidency. Yeah.
I knew that you were gonna, and I missed that part of your lesson, but one of the things that I is a reminder to me of how important it is for us to claim our own authority and our own experience and connection is, once again, there's a debate because Elder Renlund, who in a women's conference, he spoke for more time than the others together, which says something, again, a reminder that we can't wait until the current official quorums get it. We've got to claim our voice and claim our time.
Yeah.
Once again, he was kind of suggesting what was proper about what we know about the divine feminine, and how it doesn't, it's not helpful to speculate. And once again, I just think, you know, we need to learn how to have the filter of recognizing no matter what we're hearing through their filter.
Yeah.
We're hearing through our filter, but their filter. And when people, especially who have some kind of official authority, don't yet recognize that it is never a part of someone's divine authority to tell someone else what they can and can't seek.
Yeah, right.
And to put a limit on their inspiration. So he was, you know, learning how to listen to them to recognize they're telling me more about who they are and who God is. Which is important. I mean, we want to hear from each other our connection to God and our experience of God. That's great. But to never allow ourselves to be stopped or limited by that.
Yeah.
We're like enhanced in our connection and understanding of each other, but never, you know, and I, once again, I'm not trying to minimize, but, you know, that's, oh gosh, that's just so cute that anyone would ever think that it's their place to tell someone else what they can and cannot seek.
And again,
it's unfortunate. It's happening more.
Her own revelation.
Especially
what's that?
God, especially when it's women.
I'm just going to come back again and again to section 25. Emma gets to be the scribe of her own revelation.
And then she prompts other revelations, and then she gets to have her own revelation at the end when Joseph leaves. He defers to her. Basically, you're a seer, you're a prophetess.
And he's just signing off.
Yeah, and I'll sign it.
Fully empowers her. Yeah.
As his equal, which she has been all along. She mentors him. He is mentored by women. He's mentored by his mother and Sally Chase and Emma. She mentors him, you know, and he knows that she's his equal. And that's why she says at the last Relief Society meeting that she has as much authority as anyone. She's the co-founder. She's his equal. She's his parallel in every way. She's his equal. And that's why she and Brigham clash, because Brigham wants to bring her authority and the women's authority under his.
I don't think we'd have a King Follett discourse if not for Emma.
You don't think we have a what? Sorry, I didn't catch that.
King Follett discourse, some of the greatest conversations about God.
Yeah.
If not for Emma.
It's amazing. Right at the end, Joseph is just flourishing right before the end. He's just, there's just so much happening. Yeah.
So Catherine Schert says, on the other hand, Elder Renlund did talk about women speaking with the power and authority of God. The tension was there in his talk.
Yeah, it was.
Which gives me an opening. Maxine, you know that we could, you and I could go on for an hour. So, or maybe three. So I won't. I'm having to shush myself. But in kind of in that line, reading some of the things that I have seen from the church in the last 5 years, 10 years, if I were in a position of decision-making, which there are good reasons why I won't ever be in such a position, but I would read some of those instructions as saying in a ward, at a ward level, I'm coming back to the ward level, at a ward level, the Relief Society president and the Elders Quorum president, their ministry is the adult members of the ward, and the bishop's ministry is the youth of the ward. And I can read that in current instructions. I don't see a lot of people exercising that kind of instruction, but I read that as a really big move in how we could be organized and operating at a ward level.
Yeah, it's been really interesting, the recent changes. I really see us moving in the right direction in a lot of these changes that have been happening. But we still have a ways to go. We're still within that box of male authority over women that we can't seem to get out of. But yeah, I agreed with what Catherine said. I did see Elder Renlund doing both. At the beginning, I see him deferring to the Relief Society and the leaders and saying, we've heard from our Relief Society leaders, and they're kind of the, they're in charge. They're the experts on women. And then it was interesting. He said, I found it so interesting. He said, I just want to mention that the Relief Society isn't like a social organization, and it's not a charitable organization. He said, it's basically a, actually I can remember his exact words, but he said it's a, it's a women's organization that is, he basically described it as part of the priesthood, and its job is to bring salvation, bring the human family back to God, and that they're part of that process. And it struck me because for decades we were told the Relief Society is a charitable organization. It's all about charity. Charity never faileth. It's all. And he kind of pushed that aside and said, no, it's not really that. It's really this other thing, this women's order that's involved in the salvation of the human family. And then Camille Johnson said the same thing. She said, Joseph Smith restored the ancient order of women. And I haven't heard that before. I mean, that was sort of like, that was a big one. I've been saying that for 40 years, but I've never heard a church leader say that. And I went, wow, okay.
Yeah, that is a moment. Just let's have Camille, let's just have her take half the time instead.
Yeah, and I know exactly. And so we still have, ever since the Relief Society was brought under male authority, especially at the turn of the century, and then in 1970 with Priesthood Coalition, it's been frustrating. It's like, when are we going to have the courage to be what we really are? When are we going to have the courage to know and see and be the radical, mystic, lay Christian church that we are, with every member, a minister, and every member who goes to the temple is a high priest or priestess endowed with the fullness of the priesthood between them and God. That original endowment was intended to endow each individual with the fullness of the priesthood and all of the keys, so that they would be fully open to God's direction, and every man and every woman would be functioning as a high priest or priestess, as they used to do in the ancient temples, as the one who goes into the temple and communes with God. That was the whole point, was to make every member a minister and every member a high priest or priestess who could go into the temple and commune with God. And I keep wondering, so many of us who've been working on this for 40 years keep wondering, okay, when are we going to get it? When are we going to get it? Jody gets it, Jenna gets it, you all get it, Chris, Rebecca, Mike, you all get it. We get it, how many does it take to make a critical mass?
Well, I have to say, I had to go outside my tradition. I had to go outside where I was to see any of it, even though I was a member of a ward, even though that's where the power is. You don't have the vision if you don't even see the possibility. It nothing shifts. So it does take a critical mass of that. And the question is, how do we empower one another? How do we do that?
That is just such an important point, because Jana and I had a very parallel path. I didn't see it until I immersed myself in Gnostic Christianity, and I was an excommunicated member learning how to be a minister and a member of the clergy. And Jana didn't see it till she got involved in the Living School and worked with Richard Rohr on mystic Christianity, right, Jana? It's like we had to get out of this hierarchical box that we were in order to see what was really here the whole time in that amazing, lay ministry.
I had to go to a place where other people were asking the same questions from their tradition. Is the only one from Mormonism there, and just recognizing, like, oh, this is a human thing. Oh, humans are trying to enact this stuff with God. Oh, it took me being able to see the larger human stream to be able to come back and understand my own power within it. But it's so difficult to reach in the way that we're raised, in the way that our programs are run. So it's the question I'm always having is how do we do this? How do we empower one another? How do we help each other see our own power within this structure and organization?
It is a real dilemma. I've been asking that since my faith crisis in the early 80s. It's almost like the blessing of a faith crisis.
It is.
You have to be shattered in order to see it anew. And I love when Joseph Campbell said that you don't really understand your own tradition or your own culture until you get outside of it and see it from a distance and
That's right.
see it from the outside. But I would hate to think that we'll never get it. We'll never realize who and what we really are unless we all have a faith crisis and need to leave for 10 years. I don't know. I would hate, there are people who get it who don't have to go through that, but I had to go through that.
Well, I think what you did for us today, Maxine, step back. Let's not just look at 25. Let's look at it in this context of the organization of the church and of this longer human history, and God's working with his people and calling prophets and revealing truth to, so taking that step back, getting outside of just the usual reading, the usual kind of structures.
Thinking outside of the box.
Well, and I think a part of it is recognizing that it's actually a healthy and important part of any journey, any faith journey, just like human development, that you have the crises over and over. That too often it's called a crisis because it's a deconstruction and reconstruction. Instead of recognizing this is part of the journey, this is part of moving on. You look at the scriptures, you look at every account of any civilization, that's a constant, thing. Things are torn down, taken apart, and rebuilt in a new way. And that's basically what a faith crisis is. If you take it on and can get to the point where you're going, oh my word, there's nothing wrong with this. This is actually the beginning of a new life. This is kind of the death and then the rebirth on my journey over and over and over. And one thing that I appreciate, because while I took on practices that were not formally part of the church, I was led from an early age to recognize all things, no matter where they are, can contribute to the journey. And that the journey does involve the tearing apart and the rebuilding, the death and the rebirth. And that there's not, even though in the midst of it, I would think, what's wrong? What did I do wrong? It's part of it. And it's definitely not a one-time occurrence.
And it's too easy to get stuck either inside of the box and never get out, or get stuck outside of the box and be feel completely outside of it. You can't relate to it anymore. You can't see some of the good stuff that's in there. And it's not easy to come, as we all know, it's not easy to come back after having that shattering moment or whatever it is that breaks us out of the box, and then come back and figure out how to synthesize it and integrate it and be that being between two worlds who lives in paradox. And
So I see I'm the only man here. I don't know if Michael's still here.
I don't
So I'm
see
going to
him.
express my great cynicism about white men in charge, which I am convinced is going to perpetuate well beyond my lifetime. And therefore, I think that I, this is my opinion, just expressing an opinion. I think that wishing for, asking for, clamoring for more women speaking at general conference, for ordination that is recognized at a church, presidency level is, well, it's well beyond my lifetime anyway. And that the work that can really affect us on a day-to-day basis is I'm back to the ward. It's back to that, basically close-in community where I think we can make a difference, like tomorrow, like today.
I love
And
that.
I'll just say, I think that the way we can do that, because I agree with that, it is on the word level. And it's going beyond just doing our duty within the ward. It's bringing our humanity to the ward and allowing other people to bring their humanity to the ward. We will never get to a paradoxical place until we can reconcile and accept the paradox within us. We're so busy trying to run away from what is not godly within us that we never get a chance to integrate it, accept it, because that's where the real power comes. And we can do that for one another in ward. We can do that if we are willing to get vulnerable and to see one another and to sit with one another and to make places more safe and more real. Because I just think until we accept that within ourselves, we will be clamoring for something institutionally that actually cuts us off from ourselves.
Yeah.
That's exactly it. That's learning how to be a real minister. It's what I learned when I went through ministry training and chaplain training and certified as a chaplain. That's, and it is, it's us being able to be that priest, that minister, that facilitator who can create a 100% safe space for someone else to really dig down and process or to connect in a whole new powerful way they haven't been able to connect before. It's what you're doing as a coach working with people, Jana. It's what I do as a minister and a chaplain. It's and that's what it is. That's where it happens. And you're so right that we have to find that within ourselves before we can do it for others.
Absolutely. Because if we cannot learn to sit with what is uncomfortable in ourselves and one another, we will never be able to sit with the critiques, the institutional critiques.
Yeah.
We will continue to see it as evil and cut it off and
Yeah.
not really presence the real human experience that people are having,
Yeah.
especially particularly people who are not the decision makers,
Yeah.
because their experience isn't brought to the forefront. We're afraid of it and we cut it off. So,
Yeah.
I mean, there's just so much there, but I just agree with you, Chris. I think that's what the power of the word can be on a personal level, is bringing that kind of sensibility
Yeah.
to being in communion with people we actually know and see and can understand their lives. But we've got to be willing to bring that forward. We've got to be willing to sit with what's imperfect.
Yeah,
Yeah,
that's exactly
as
it.
in a comment that Lori Forsyth, has here, she says, fascinating to think about doing that work together in a ward and a challenge when the people you're with are clamoring to make sure that we're just checking the boxes and not rocking the boat. Yeah.
That's part of
So you have to be the leaven in the lump. You have to be
right.
that little piece of agitation in some ways, which is hard to do personally because we just want everyone to love us, right?
And that's part of the paradox of being in community in a ward is you will be there with the ones who just want to check the boxes and not rock the boat. And I think part of being vulnerable and creating the space for others to step into the vulnerability is letting go of needing a result. Letting go of thinking, okay, I'm here to prove that I can hold this calling. Or to please someone so that they will have me do this. Let go, and we go through those periods where we're in that check the boxes and there's nothing wrong with it. For the most part, it will kind of take care of one aspect of the ward. But to be in the step into the space so that you are going to church not to check the boxes, but to see, I wonder what adventure I'll have today. What opportunity will I have to share a part of myself that I'm wrestling with? What opportunity will I have to listen to someone else who is feeling they're on their own?
Yeah.
But by being a space of listening, they feel they can be vulnerable. And
Right.
what's really amazing is it might take time, but individuals can actually transform a ward community by
Yeah.
going because it's an opportunity to practice being godlike, not
Right.
because you're going to check the boxes and see what happens. And yes, there might be times when it's just like, oh gosh, not today, Satan, and you walk out. But to be willing to, the last time I bore my testimony, I got up and I just said, I need to share with my ward family. I'm struggling. I'm really struggling with the results of the election and how I'm seeking God. And that's a risk I've had to practice taking over years. Someone else hasn't practiced that yet. But in that space, and over the years, I've seen other people who gradually stopped worrying about checking the boxes, who gradually were released from high-level callings, but they step into that vulnerability and they
Yeah.
share their struggles, and they come to church and they come to the Ward family to truly feel heard or not alone or mourn or just I'm here to mourn and I need someone to mourn with me. I'm here carrying a burden and I'm sharing this burden because I can't carry it alone. And when people step into vulnerability, a ward community really becomes a transformative community. But yeah, it takes there's a lot of letting go of those
Yeah.
boxes.
There are a couple of things that really can disarm those people who are monitoring other people and wanting to, who are threatened by people who are self-possessed and self-empowered. And that is what you said, to share vulnerability. When people show and share their vulnerability, it helps other people to relax and feel like, oh, okay, now I can be me too. You know, it really helps to disarm all that. So sharing vulnerability, I think, is just this automatic catalyst for helping people to let go of judging each other or feeling bad about themselves. They're not good enough and they're judging you to see if you're good enough. They just let go and go, oh wow, I can be me. And then the other thing is letting people know that I'm a safe space for them. I mean, people always, for 12 years now, people say, how can you be a feminist and go back to the church? And the church is awful and people are horrible to feminists. And yeah, all that is true. So they think, well, how are you able to do it? What kind of concessions are you making? Are you just, you know, a yes person and going along? And I'm like, no, I give everyone safe space. They know that I am safe space. I'm a minister, I'm a chaplain. They can be whoever they really are. They can say whatever they want to me. And they all know that. And what's been amazing, I mean, it disarms things. And I've been amazed by some of the things that I've been able to facilitate and do in this tw last 12 years. And I've been amazed by how many people will share their own private struggles, including church employees, people at PR and church leaders. They'll share with me, oh, they feel safe. They're like, okay, I can say what I'm really thinking of feeling right now. And I've been amazed by how much people have opened up to me and what they've said, because it is safe. I will never repeat it. It's sacred. It's confidential. This is their struggle of their soul. But I want them to know they are safe. I don't have any answers for them. I'm a safe space for them to dig and find their answers. That's what I learned in chaplain training. And I am that one space they can come to no matter what's going on, no matter what. And it, you know, I'm safe and they can process it, they can share it, and it won't be shared with anyone else.
Maxine, that I love that. You know, we've had conversations, but you may want to come to whether you count that as your closing comment or have another closing comment. Rebecca and I were just exchanging a note about who's in charge here. We've been about an hour after chat, and then Rebecca sends me a message saying I have to go. So I'm here saying an hour is probably good, and we all need to move on to other things. But if you want a last line, why don't you have a chance. Here it is. And then we'll be thankful and grateful for what you've given us and close this session.
Oh my gosh. Everybody said it. It's what everyone said. Be that spiritual, be that minister, that lay minister of Christ that God knows you are and you feel a need to be or desire to be. Be that voice of God no matter what. And bring that, enable that shift to happen in your relationships and in your ward level. It's amazing how much we influence each other, even just with the tone of our voice. We can make someone's day or break someone's day, and other people can make our day or break our day. We have influence, and so be that influence of safe space and God's love, no matter what, and just be it, and we will change it one by one.